Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to bonus episode 254. Today's guest is Dr. Julie Bindeman, a reproductive psychologist at Integrative Therapy of Greater Washington. We will be discussing ways to cope when your fertility treatment has been put on hold indefinitely or your cycle has been canceled. You can find Dr. Bindeman online at www.greaterwashingtontherapy.com. And as always, don't forget to visit our website for more information about this episode at beatinfertility.co/bonus254. Take a listen. Hi, Dr. Bindeman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, I am anxious to talk to you about this because it's a bit of a crazy time.
Well, I was going to say, I think anxiety is the word of the day.
It definitely is. It definitely is. But before we get into that, I'd actually like to hear a little bit about you. Tell us about your academic background and training.
Sure. So I am a reproductive psychologist, which is sort of a title I give myself. I was trained as a clinical psychologist from the George Washington University and have specialized in reproductive health now for nearly 12 years. And since it's my focus, those of us in the field have kind of dubbed ourselves reproductive psychologists. It would be a subset of health psychology. I had postdoctoral training in the field, including several years of supervision as well as a year long of coursework, and then started to work with people around infertility, around pregnancy loss, birth trauma, and postpartum mental health issues.
And why exactly did you choose a career in this type of therapy?
Sure. Yeah, it's not exactly one that we hear a whole lot about. And when I was in graduate school, I actually had no idea that it existed. I would say that my own reproductive journey really led me to it and showed me the importance of having someone that not only has the didactic training, but also that one version of the lived experience can be two really useful pieces of the puzzle coming together. I know that for me in my journey, being in therapy was really useful, and having somebody understand all it was that I was going through was also really, really useful. Not having to show up in therapy and then have to play the role of educator and feel like, oh, now I'm helping somebody else instead of getting the help. And that was the reason that I was there. So that was something I was really appreciative of. And so many of my clients have expressed that as well. So I actually say that I didn't necessarily choose the career path. It chose me.
Are you comfortable sharing your story?
Sure. I think a lot of people wouldn't automatically consider my story to be an infertility story. My story involves the definition of infertility being extending to the inability to give birth. I had recurrent pregnancy losses, and I started out having an uncomplicated pregnancy, and that is my oldest child. And then in trying to give that child a sibling, I had a miscarriage, and then I had two terminations in the second trimester for medical reasons. Unfortunately, we carry a unknown recessive gene that causes the brain to not form. So I learned midway through each of these pregnancies that the babies I were carrying didn't have a brain, and that could have led to stillbirth. It would have led to certainly a very shortened or very perilous life should we have continued in the pregnancy and had them live. And so we made two very devastating, heartbreaking decisions, deciding to prematurely end those pregnancies rather than continuing with them. And then my fifth and sixth pregnancies led to two healthy children. And after that, we called it a day. So I didn't have the help of a fertility clinic because I was told, since we didn't know what the gene was, a fertility clinic wouldn't be useful to us. I do have a story of what infertility is like, and seeing all of my friends go on and have their babies and it not be a problem, and me just sort of sitting there feeling so stuck and feeling so helpless and feeling so sad.
Well, here at Beat Infertility, we definitely consider recurrent pregnancy loss under the definition of infertility.
Sure. I know that recurrent pregnancy loss is now one that ASRM has recently added as they've expanded their definition of infertility. So that's something that I've been really appreciative for, because it starts to give voice to so many different people whose fertility journeys are different.
So once this career chose you, take us through the rest of it. How did you end up where you are now?
My career chose me at the beginning of my career, or my focus chose me sort of at the beginning. I was working in a group practice. It's where I met my business partner, and the two of us basically decided that we should strike out on our own. And so we did so. And at that same time, that was during my childbearing years. And after I had my first child, I started to get training in postpartum and perinatal mood issues. And then, of course, after all of my losses, started to get training in infertility and pregnancy loss and birth trauma. And so the practice had already been started as all of this was happening. It kind of grew together with me and my business partner and I. Initially, it was just going to be the two of us. And as time kept passing, we would get questions about people working with kids or people doing psychoeducational evaluations. And those were things that my partner and I didn't offer anymore. So we were able to connect with some other really talented clinicians, and they've joined us. And we really love the team that we have. And we're all kind of figuring out this brave new world together.
Let's move into the topic of today, because we have a lot to discuss. I want to start off a bit more broad before we get into specifics. So in general, what are your tips for infertility warriors about coping with stressful situations?
So my tip for infertility warriors are no different than my tip for just everyday people dealing with stressful situations, because stress doesn't discriminate based upon what your actual journey is. And they sound so simple, which is being aware of what it is you can control and starting to focus on those things, being aware of the parts of life you cannot control, and maybe choosing to think about them less by focusing on the things that you can control, being good to your body, getting your body moving in whatever way you're able to, whether that is stretching, whether that is a high intensity routine, a run, a walk, yoga, whatever might feel good to your body. Those are the things that you should do to help support it. We know our research suggests that managing stress, it's not exactly novel ideas that I'm going to come up with, but it's human behavior in trying to complete those ideas, which is the hard part. So it's these simple things like exercise, like managing your thoughts, like getting the sleep that you need, like choosing to have foods that are going to be more helpful than hurtful. So lots of processed foods, lots of sugar tend to change our moods differently than the way that unprocessed foods and foods without added sugar treat our body.
You stole the next couple of questions from me, but I'm going to ask them anyway, just in case you have something else to add. In general, how can listeners identify and deal with aspects of their journeys that they cannot control?
This is particularly the case now, where there is something that not only infertility warriors, but everybody is dealing with, something that is outside of our tangible control. So for some people, writing down those things can be really useful. Like, here are the things I can control. And then on maybe the other side of the piece of paper, here are the things I cannot control. One exercise I suggest to people is writing down the different things that you can't control and maybe cutting them into shreds. And then you can rip each one up, or you can burn it if there's a safe place to do so, of course. you can bury it outside, things like that. Just sort of a literal representation of getting rid of those things. So that can be an exercise that's really helpful for people.
I love that, especially the burning and burying. That made me totally crack up on my muted end here.
Well, I'm so glad.
I also just wanted to follow up that question with something else. Have you found that sometimes when people write down the things they can't control, that they actually turn out to be things that they can control once they think about it a little bit?
I think there's certainly things, like if you're talking about something like, oh, but I can't go out, so how do I work out? Like I can't go to my gym and my gym is closed, so how do I work out? So this is just sort of an example to the question you posed to me. Yeah, if you sit and you think about it a little more, saying, okay, well, I can't go to my gym and I can't control my gym opening, but what I can control is how I move my body. And the really cool thing is humans haven't always needed gyms as a way of exercising their bodies. So go on a walk, put on sneakers, do stretching, do yoga. Pop on a video video makes me sound so old. Pop on a YouTube clip around what you might do something physically. There's so many free online offerings right now about how to get people to move their body because we know exercise is such a key component of stress reduction. And the other piece that I hadn't mentioned is, and something that we all can control is, what about our daily routines can we control? So humans crave routine. We crave the things that we know and feel familiar. And it might feel like, oh my gosh, but if we're stuck at home, how do we create that routine? So it might be simple, like, okay, when am I going to eat my meals? Let me do that like I did when I was before this pandemic struck us. Or, okay, let me make sure that my sleep, I'm still going to sleep at the same time, that I'm still setting an alarm to wake up at the same time, that I'm getting the same kind of exercise that I'm used to if that was something that was part of my routine, that I am taking the time to talk to others if I'm only living with one other person or if I'm living on my own.
Okay, so maybe another tip to listeners, just reading into your answer there, is before you burn it or bury it, perhaps think on it for a second.
Yes, thank you for that.
Okay, so my next question, again, sort of overlaps with what we've just been talking about, but how can listeners identify and take advantage of aspects of their infertility journey that they can control?
Yeah, so I think a lot of what I was saying is, we can control things that are germane to the human existence. So we all need to eat. We can control what we put into our bodies. As tempting as it is to only eat ice cream, cookies, and pizza, maybe we make some choices to find some fruits, to find some vegetables, even if they're freeze-dried, even if they're frozen. Those are all fine choices just to give our bodies some nourishment, those building blocks. We can make the choices to move our bodies and we can choose how to do that. And maybe we choose different ways of doing that on different days. We can choose who we engage with and when we engage with them. So if family is supportive to you, make sure that you're reaching out to them. If they're not supportive to you, then, maybe it's okay to practice this physical distancing from them. Reaching out to the friends that you find supportive, or even connecting with people that you haven't connected with in a long time. Everyone is feeling palpably this sense of isolation, this sense of being in our own houses and having to be physically apart from others. So that kind of connecting on the phone, via text, via Messenger, via Skype, FaceTime, whatever modalities you have, really, there's an opportunity to strengthen relationships, to strengthen support.
Okay, let's get into more specifics here. How can listeners put all of this news in perspective?
I think what's really hard to do is that the news keeps changing. And I think it also depends upon what you're hearing based upon what your news source is. So managing differing ideas about what is optimal for health and safety. And I really recommend people look to trusted news or trusted health support at this point. So looking at the World Health Organization, that's a really good trusted news source. Looking at the National Institutes of Health, that's a really good trusted source too, that's giving good health information. And sometimes the health information we're getting is different from how our government response is, or how our state response is if you're living in the United States. And so that can be really confusing too. We can feel really overwhelmed by all of the news that's coming out. So one of the things I suggest to my clients is you can choose where you're getting the news and how often you're listening to news. You can choose to delete the Facebook app on your phone. And that doesn't mean delete your account, but it means that if you want to check Facebook, then you're doing so on your computer versus having it so easy on your phone. And you can do the same with Twitter, with Insta, whatever kind of platforms you're using that might not be useful platforms right now. You know, again, evaluating what are the news sources and how often you need to listen to those news sources.
How can listeners balance being informed about the pandemic while not increasing their stress and anxiety?
I think you're choosing how much to listen to it each day, that it's important to not be an ostrich and dig your head in the sand and pretend none of this is happening. To remember the parts that are within your control, and to remember that this will pass. You know, the last time we had a pandemic was over 100 years ago, and that passed. So we have some kind of historical perspective to glean from, except none of us were alive then. I guess the other thing I look at it for this, and what I say to my clients all the time, is choose to do things that are going to keep you safe. And while it seems like this might not be too big of a deal if you were to get it, I actually have a friend who's had it now. She's going on her second week of being ill and has just said that it is the worst illness she's ever experienced. She's been by herself and, you know, she's really made pleas with people to keep themselves safe, to stay at home if they can. So that for me really hit home. And going back to one of the things that I say to my clients is that if we were to have a pandemic like this, we picked a great time in history to do it because we can be so connected to one another through our phones, through texting, through email, through Skype technology and face-to-face video conferencing. I mean, what opportunities versus even 25 years ago, I was joking with a friend and I'm like, gosh, can you imagine having to survive this with dial-up internet? Like, wow. And so this kind of connectiveness that we can have is really an opportunity at this time. So being able to think about that again, physical distancing doesn't mean that we have to socially be distant from one another. And so I think that was probably the worst term the experts could have is the idea of social distancing, because us psychologists sit there and say, no, we don't want social distancing, maybe not in proximity physically, but yes, stay socially connected. Just let's distance ourselves physically.
I agree with you. I thought that was such a weird term to use. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense because you do want to be connected with people right now.
We are such social creatures and we need to be connected with people. So I think you're absolutely right. It sends this idea that's really contrary to a human need.
Just a quick plug here. If people are looking for someone new to connect with, there's always the Beat Infertility community, which you can find at beatinfertility.co/app. So definitely check that out. If you're not already a member, it's a super supportive community. Hey, Infertility Warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. Regular listeners of the show know that I struggled during my infertility journey with everything from finding the right clinic to advocating for a protocol customized to my body to allowing infertility to consume my entire existence and everything in between. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side and have interviewed hundreds of other warriors and fertility experts, I've discovered the fastest way to realize your dream of becoming a parent is to get educated, regain hope, build resiliency, learn self-advocacy skills, and partner with someone who's been there. Whether you're an infertility newbie or a seasoned veteran, it would be my honor and privilege to provide, as one client put it, unwavering support with fully engulfing and genuine empathy. If you'd like to learn more or schedule a free 30-minute call to discuss how I can support you during your infertility journey, go to beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show. How can listeners take this time to make themselves as healthy as possible? I know you mentioned a few things earlier, but hopefully you can add to that.
I think the other way too is we react based upon our framework, based upon how we decide to think about something. So if we're thinking about things as like, I must do this, I should do that, that's not really useful. That can be a really shaming kind of framework that we put ourselves in, because if we fall short, we feel badly. But if we shift it to, it would be my preference to do this, that really changes how we're talking to ourselves. So I think looking at it as, okay, I have an opportunity to have some time that I hadn't planned for, but with this opportunity, what can I do with it? Do I have the opportunity maybe to start exercising in a way that I hadn't? Do I have an opportunity to expand my social connection network? Do I have an opportunity here to educate myself on what are some options that might fall to me? Or again, just what are my opportunities here? And looking at it this way, do you have an opportunity maybe to start a new hobby? And I know that sounds kind of silly because we're talking about infertility, but it's actually a really useful thing. Certainly, infertility treatments and going through infertility journeys can be such a drain on how we think about things. So being able to focus on other things, being able to find that we're good at other skills is a really useful aspect to have in your toolkit. So taking this time maybe to start with new skills, to start with new hobbies. If you've never learned the guitar, but you really want to, this is a great time to do that. And music can be so cathartic. You know, this is a time where you're like, you know, I've never really run a 5K, but maybe like, this is a great time to start that.
I always use books to escape to another world. So I just want to put it out there. If anyone is looking for book recommendations, I am your girl.
Awesome. And I would also suggest that maybe books not about fertility struggles, because if you really want an escape, like maybe not having that as part of it. Maybe also not some nonfiction books right now, too.
I only read fiction, and I'm on a big fantasy kick right now. So.
Awesome. Awesome. So absolutely.
What advice do you have for listeners whose cycles have been canceled by their clinic, but they know other clinics in their area are continuing business as usual? This is so hard.
This is so hard. And certainly there's been a lot of mixed feedback to last week's ASRM guidelines. So ASRM, which is the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, recently put out guidelines being able to look at what's happening in other countries and starting to see the trends in the US and saying that, you know, the best way of managing this is to not have contact with so many people, because then we're reducing the spread. And so as such, they said, you know, all elective kinds of surgeries, all elective procedures, those should halt. And I think the way they were looking at it is from an ethical framework of putting people in potential danger. And I'm not trying to speak for them because I was not involved in any of this, but certainly the way my colleagues and I think about it is we've been looking at it through this sort of ethical lens of this greater good. And I think what's so hard about it is human beings are not primed to think about the greater good. We are more primed to think about ourselves. And of course, that makes sense. I think it's a really hard thing to step out of yourself and say, okay, me pausing this cycle is a way of helping the greater good. Because that's not what you, I know, want right now. So it might be a framework that is useful to you to think about, I think another, I mean, when I look at the clinics that are open, I'm kind of aghast by it because of all the potential people that they are putting in harm's way. And I know that not everyone would agree with me when I say that. They're putting their staff in harm's way. They're putting prospective patients in harm's way. And my concerns are not only about what's happening now, but I also think about, we have such little information about what this virus does to pregnancy. The only cases that we've seen have been transmission from mother to baby after birth. We don't know what's happening so far. We are seeing that it's not transmitted in breast milk. It doesn't seem to be transmitted placentally. But again, I don't know how much data there's actually out about that. We don't know if this is something like CMS or Zika that can really impact a pregnancy, or if it's something more benign like a cold or the flu, which doesn't impact a pregnancy. But we do know that pregnancy is an immune compromised state. And so even just having a virus on this puts a person through such a toll, because there's so little that they can do except kind of wait it out. So thinking about, do I want to be pregnant now? Do I want to be pregnant when things are uncertain? Do I want to be pregnant when my medical care might be compromised because my doctors are getting sick, or the doctor's offices are having to close down, or because I'm not emergent, I can't come in and I have to do telemedicine during my pregnancy? Do I want to be in a pregnancy where in my delivery, maybe only my partner can be in the delivery room? Maybe I'm not sure what hospitals are going to look like 9 months from now, what kind of supply situation is going to be there. So I think these are also really important questions for people to ask themselves, that it's not only about obtaining pregnancy, but what will it be like right now in this uncertainty to be pregnant?
I want to dive into that just a little bit further.
Please.
Just like it's possible to be happy for someone else who's pregnant, but sad for yourself, I'm wondering how you deal with that envy in this situation, because I think a lot of people understand what's going on and the risks and everything, but there's still that envy because their friend down the road is continuing cycling.
Right. And I think, you know, again, the part to remember is that if they're continuing cycling, they're given a potential chance, but just because they're cycling doesn't mean that they will get pregnant. You know, we hope that for people, we hope that for everyone, but unfortunately we don't have 100% pregnancy rates. So I think that's just another part to keep in mind. It is really hard to hold two things, especially I'm happy for my friend and I'm sad or I'm jealous for me. And that dialectic is okay. It's okay to feel both. It's okay to acknowledge both. It's okay even to say to your friend, oh God, why didn't I choose that clinic? It's okay also potentially to worry for your friend. Oh my gosh, are they going to be okay? Are they exposed? Like, I hope that everything's okay for them too, because that might be another part of it. So I think that that's something that I wish I had magic in which I could say, oh, here's what everyone should do when they're feeling the dialectical. But I think being able to name that I'm having two feelings and that it's okay to have two feelings and to not try to push those feelings down. So if it helps you to write about your feelings, do that. If it helps you to talk about your feelings, do that. If it helps you to run while you're having really strong feelings, do that. Whatever these kinds of methods that you use in managing feelings, continue to do so.
Watching baseball this time of year is typically my zen zone.
Oh,
and yeah.
I'm so sorry. Well, reruns, right?
Gonna have to go back to the classics, yes.
You know what? All you have to do is watch last season of the Nationals. I mean, that's something I could watch over and over.
Okay, yes. If only I was a Nationals fan. I am from the south side of Chicago, so it's the White Sox all the way.
Got it.
And we were going to be really, really, really good this year. So,
well,
I don't
know. Undefeated right now. So how's that?
That is my attitude at the start of every season, that right now we are undefeated.
Right. Exactly. You have a perfect, perfect ratio of wins to losses.
Okay, so moving on to a much more serious topic, and I actually really, really, really want to hear your answer to this. What advice do you have for women of advanced reproductive age specifically? Because time is so important for them.
This is really where my heart goes out to my clients, where, you know, there's a reality issue here. I think it's important to have frank conversations with your clinic and being able to say, okay, so I understand that you're closed. Like, what really are my options here? My hope is that things will be up and running sooner versus later. But I know that for people of advanced age, every day feels like, oh my gosh, you don't have that day to wait. It's to take some breaths and see if there's other things that you can focus on, because right now there's nothing that we can do to change it. It might be where if you haven't started talking about using donor gametes, donor egg, or donor sperm, maybe that's a conversation, not because you're going to make a decision, but a conversation to have, saying like, okay, so this option might be taken away from us. And do we even consider this? Is it so important for us to have children that are genetically related to us that is really our only path? Are we open potentially in down the road of having other paths and looking at other paths? So these might be conversations to start having, as painful as they might be. And I really just want to stress that these are my clients, that really all of our hearts really go out, and we are there and we are sad with you and we are anxious with you as well, because we understand that time is the one entity that we can't get back.
So what about people who are older and that clinic down the road is still open? Should they be thinking about jumping ship?
I think everyone has to come to that conclusion themselves. If it is something that they, and again, being what ASRM guidelines are, and in my state, our governor has actually shut down all outpatient procedures. So it's not a guideline anymore in my state. It's actually a mandate by the governor, which is really different. So I think that's one thing too for people to look at is, you know, are they in compliance with whatever state protections are being enacted? Because unfortunately, we have 50 different states and 50 different ways of looking at this right now. So that might be one thing to look at too. If you are looking at it, you might want to talk to the clinic and say, okay, how are you maintaining both your safety and my safety? Looking at them, are they going to take on more cases? Are they only working with existing people with cycles already in progress? Looking at, you know, maybe can they just do a retrieval cycle and then we're just going to cryopreserve, and maybe that's sort of that halting point for you. But certainly it's not something that, from an ethical framework, that I could condone for people to do, although I recognize that people are going to make their own choices.
You sort of addressed this already, but in case you had anything else to add, how can listeners communicate with their clinics and stay informed about their policies during this time?
Most clinics are posting things on their websites, on their Instagram feeds, on their Facebook pages, on their Twitter feeds. So those are great ways of keeping in touch with your clinic, seeing what they're doing. I think nurses tend to be a touch point for people. So if you have an assigned nurse, emailing them, getting or calling them, seeing what policies are, how you might adapt to them. Doctors are able to provide telehealth. So seeing if maybe you can schedule a consultation with your RE about, okay, what are my options? What are we doing? What recommendations would they make? So taking advantage of those different ways of contact.
What other questions should listeners be asking their clinics?
It's important to look at, okay, what are the procedures clinics are willing to do and able to do at this time? And again, that might be different and that might keep on changing based upon what state regulations become imposed or become relaxed. So that's another piece to this too, that's really in flux, is that you might start a cycle and that be fine. And then the state changes its recommendations, or it changes its mandates, and it might then interrupt a cycle. So, you know, are you prepared to have a cycle interrupted, not because of yourself too? That's something else I think is really important to think about. Talking to your clinics about, what is the monitoring plan if pregnancy is achieved? Are they able to monitor you? What is the plan in terms of getting transferred to OB? Looking at that. And again, it's a lot about safety, about what their cleaning policies are right now, asking about if there's up-to-date information around transmission. I think that's really important too to know.
Something else that I discussed with Dr. Allison Rogers, who's a reproductive endocrinologist with the Fertility Centers of Illinois, we discussed this in another episode. She was saying that embryology labs have to be managed by human beings. Yeah. So I think that might be another question to ask as well. How are you managing the embryology lab and keeping my embryos safe during this time?
Right, absolutely. And keeping the embryologists safe. Because they are the ones that are the gatekeepers of the embryos.
Yes, yes, yes. I did not mean to diminish the human beings in this. Absolutely, absolutely. You mentioned telehealth earlier, and in the past, at least my experience, telehealth has been difficult. So how might telehealth now play a positive role, and should listeners first check with their insurance companies about their telehealth coverage?
Again, we don't have policies that are countrywide in the United States, but so it will be important to check on if you have an insurance commission in your state, checking there. But a lot of the big insurance companies, being that we're dealing with a crisis on our hands, have really relaxed telehealth. I can speak to my own state. I know that Cigna, United, Aetna, and Blue Cross have done that, where they will now pay if they previously hadn't paid. Federal programs will now do that. CMS, which is part of the federal part of insurance, issued a mandate to cover telehealth services. I guess one of the opportunities in this is that therapy and telehealth is becoming more and more available. Where we're still really constrained as practitioners is our license portability is still very much restricted into whatever state or states that we are licensed in. So we don't have a nationwide license that could enable me who practices in Maryland and is licensed in Maryland to treat someone in California, because I don't have a license there. So that's still one of the things we need to overcome. But there are plenty of people in each state that have this kind of specialization and are practicing via telehealth and are practicing so in an ethically and a responsible way, making sure that the telehealth products were used are HIPAA compliant, that we're ensuring your safety in that. So that's been, again, a real, if we're even looking at the gifts of this, which I don't know that people are ready to see that yet, but that might be a potential gift in all of this.
Just one thought of my own that I wanted to add. If you were already thinking about exploring other fertility clinics outside of this whole thing, now might be a good time to get that telehealth consult with them.
When I think about telehealth services, certainly it's something that is available both in medicine as well as in terms of therapy. In most states, insurance companies are relaxing their telehealth guidelines, and they are allowing people to get reimbursed just as they would for an in-person visit for a telehealth consult. So now could be a great time that if you were thinking about switching clinics or you just wanted to gather information for the future, to schedule a telehealth consult with other docs. They're all doing that right now. The other piece is that if you needed emotional support, my colleagues and I are offering telehealth services. We are limited, though, to the state or states that we're licensed in. So that's the one caveat right now. But as I said, most insurance companies are reimbursing for services.
My experience in the past with therapists has been that their wait lists are so long and they're not taking on other clients. I can't imagine that that's any better right now.
Certainly, we are working a lot, and we're trying to do our best to support people. I think what some therapists, including myself, are doing is we're starting more groups. So I just started an infertility support, general infertility support group that's going to be meeting on the first of the month. It's going to be a video group, so that makes it easier. So if people are interested in that, absolutely. It's more of a support group versus a therapy group, but at least it can give you in-person support with other people that you can see and hear, and not only people that you need to type with. So it's a different avenue. So sorry to make a plug for that. But I think that's really important too, that people are starting to really try to offer some more spots. Telehealth gives us our commute times back, so that can be helpful too for us. And certainly I'm training more mental health professionals to do this work so that there are others that are able and available to do this work and are competent to do so. I think that's another big piece as well.
For listeners who are suddenly working from home, what tips do you have for coping with the change in their situation as well as suddenly being so isolated?
Pop-up of virtual happy hours or other kinds of virtual things, I think it's really important to start engage in calls with friends that you're setting up. My neighborhood is doing a virtual trivia night, which I'm really excited for because, again, it's connection. We're going to be using Zoom, which is a platform where you can both see and hear people, and that's great. So just really excited for those kinds of opportunities, these kinds of just creativity. Some things that I've talked to my friends about, like friends that we used to go on walks, I'll say, hey, why don't we take our phone? We can talk with one another while each of us is going on a walk in our own place. And that way we still have kind of that connection. I was joking with one of my friends who tends to walk really fast. And I'm like, yeah, the best part about this is I don't have to keep up with you. I can just go at my own pace. So these are all just different ideas on how to stay connected, of being creative about it. I have a group of friends and we have a weekly Zoom date where we just stay in touch, and you know, you can bring your cocktail or mocktail with you, and it's an hour, and it's just really, really nice to have that in-person connection. So I think it's important to carden out your workday to have the times that you're working and the times that you're not working. And really, again, that can be part of your schedule. It's so easy to be like, well, I'm at home. It's 8 o'clock. I've got nothing to do. Let me check my email. But really try to resist doing that. You know, really give yourself the time and the space to work, and then the time and the space when you're off. I think going outside, whether you're going on a walk or not, but just being able to breathe in fresh air can be really, really useful. You know, even if you're just sitting outside for a couple of minutes, that can be really, really useful and restorative. Going on walks is great. If you have nature nearby, whether it's the beach or whether it's the woods or just grass or the plains, whatever you can do, I would go on a walk in that. Being in nature can feel really different and feel really restorative. I know for myself, I was just feeling so much last weekend and then decided to take a walk in the woods nearby my house. And after an hour of being in the woods and being in the creek, and I was taking pictures of some stuff just to keep those memories for myself, I felt like a brand new person. I just felt energized. I felt happier. So these kinds of really, really simple things can really assist in this. But this is a time to really try to make what those separations are. If you can try not to work in your bedroom so that that's a place that's separate than your workplace, I think that can be really important too. Or can you transform part of your bedroom to be where you work and maybe not do that on your bed? Again, it's these sort of small, simple things, but they can be really, really meaningful.
Before I move into my last question, is there any other tips that you'd like to add for people?
I think just to reiterate, moving your bodies, making the choices that you can make, and staying socially connected are the biggest things that I can suggest to people right now.
What words of hope would you offer to women whose fertility treatments have been put on hold?
I would offer the idea of the framework that your baby is out there, and it might just take a little bit longer to bring that baby to you, but that doesn't mean that your hope for a baby and a family has to end right now. For some people, what I say to them that might be useful, people that it's really hard because of so many disappointments to keep on hoping, is I say to them that I'm happy to hold their hope for them. And when we talk together, we can talk about that hope, but that I'll be holding it. I'll be nurturing that hope so that they don't have to feel that. They don't have to do that. And you know, we can, again, look at it together. You know, for me personally, that was something that was really useful on my journey, is having that designated friend that was my hope holder, just really appreciating her for that. I'd look at it as a framework of, okay, how else can I use this time? Can I really give myself the opportunity of not thinking about fertility, of not being on that hamster wheel right now? And that can be a real gift, even though I know it doesn't feel like that right now.
Dr. Brindemann, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Always happy to be a part.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.